If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is continuing live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Read this. Mr. Altenburn, is there anything that you want to tell me about this language? And I'll go to Mr. Elegant as to his thoughts about this language.
Well, at some point I do want to explain to you, you know, why it is that I think we need to have more on foreseeability if we're using the substantial factor test and explaining in a little more detail why I still believe that's a mistake. As we tell your ruling in open court earlier here, I had at least assumed that we were making a substantial factor, meaning irresistible impulse. And so it won't take me long to do it, but I need to try to do that.
Sure. Go ahead.
You want me to do that now? I'm happy.
Might as well.
Okay. So I've cited the cases we've discussed before and taking quotes out of them. And so in describing these, the case law always goes into the importance that there's qualitatively something different about foreseeability here as well as causation of suicide. And I've gone through a laundry list of options with you, all of which have been rejected about what the intent should be, but we're down basically now to the remaining irresistible impulse is more or less the same language that the plaintiffs requested initially out of Nelson. Nelson is under FELA, you know, minimal negligence language, but it's the only thing we have in Florida. So if we're going to use that, I've tried to put this in here in the context of a tort that is designed to only hit suicide on the rarest of circumstances, which FELA law is, if there's any negligence, you win. So that language has been adjusted there. But the problem with the substantial factor test, and I was thinking about this last night, but as an example, I have an uncle, Edward Gamm, Mon Damon, Iowa. He was a good Catholic. He was a husband. He had two boys. And many years ago, he committed suicide. He had been on a crew of a bomber that got shot down over Germany during the Second World War, and Adolf Hitler's army put him in a concentration camp for an extended period of time. He did not commit suicide until many years thereafter, but I will tell you right now that I believe that Adolf Hitler's army was a substantial factor in the suicide of my uncle. And I will believe that viscerally until the day I die. That's an emotional feeling on my part. And maybe somewhat moral feeling on my part, but it's not a legal duty. And the reason that we have made suicide something that we place the duty upon the person who does it, that we make it an independent intervening cause is because there are many public policy reasons to do that. The legislature hasn't recognized this tort, and so far the appellate courts of Florida have not. And there are reasons we do that because, again, I checked last night, the CDC estimates that in 2022, there were nearly, I think it was 3,400 suicides in Florida. I guarantee you that at least 2,000 of those families who lost a loved one will tell you that they're not going to tell you, well, it was all his fault. He did it. It was an independent intervening cause, and it's all over. As human beings, the first thing we think about when someone commits suicide is, well, what caused that? What was the trigger? Why did Mr. Bill do that? And that's good therapy for us to try to search for those things. And as from a preventative standpoint, something that the government should work on to try to keep people from committing suicide. But, you know, the Kowalskis clearly think that DCF was a substantial factor. They think our client was a substantial factor. They even probably think that Judge Hayward was a substantial factor. And I'll tell you clearly on the record that Judge Hayward played absolutely no part whatsoever in what we're dealing with in this case. But if we have an instruction that goes to the jury and you know, that says on the verdict form, we've modified this, that the did John Hopkins All Children's Hospital, through the intentional or reckless acts of its employees, engage in conduct was sufficiently extreme and outrageous that it caused Beata Kowalski, excuse me, I'm reading the wrong one, that did the employees commit extreme and outrageous conduct that was the legal cause of severe emotional distress that was sufficient to be a substantial factor in Beata Kowalski's suicide? If we ask the jury that, just like the 2,000 families who have to believe that it was something else that at least something was a substantial factor, that's the analysis they go through. That isn't the law now. It shouldn't be the law. And so I believe that we should not give this, but if we do, we need to emphasize at least that for the law, this has to be something that's foreseeable, where the person can say while they're doing the conduct, yeah, you know what, this can cause him to commit suicide. So what? That's reckless disregard. But unless we have something very, very strong on this, when we give them this thing on the verdict form, they're going to do exactly what those 2,000 families did last year in Florida. And we'll have lawsuits down the road, not just this one now that's the first in Florida. We'll have lots of lawsuits about this if this becomes the law. So I want a jury instruction that's as strong as possible, at least. Even though, frankly, I guess if one is weaker, it's better for me on appeal. But I feel obligated to get one that's as strong as possible.
Mr. Elegant, on the comments that Mr. Altenburn just made, any response?
I'm a little unclear. Was that going to the part that talks about the second test you apply?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I don't think we have a problem with the wording of the paragraph that starts the second test. I have some issues with some of the stuff above.
I guess I'm talking about the more generalized comments that Mr. Altenburn, before we get to the specific language. I mean, he's looking at this, and his argument was at the conceptual level.
We talked about that before, and I mean, there's some things that I would do differently. I mean, we had talked about whether it could be a rational decision or not, and that's not in here, and I'm not going to ask for that. I suspect we've all been either families or friends that have been touched by suicide, and it's a tragic situation, and I think the jury will decide if it was a factor or not, and I don't think it's automatic. I mean, it'll be based on everything they've heard, so The way the verdict form is going to be broken down, we'll have to see what the exact questions are, but there's going to be one question for the irresistible impulse, and there's going to be one question for the substantial factor. And so later on, and I think you already said this yesterday, later on, if the appellate court decides it's one and not the other, then they'll have the guidance to sort through that. So.
Let me just make a couple of observations about Mr. Altenburn's comments, and then we'll get to the specific language. What I'm hearing Mr. Altenburn effectively make is basically a slippery slope, that we're going to open up the floodgates to and basically energize a previously almost dormant cause of action, and under that cause of action, we'll now recognize a whole panoply of situations that previous to today, Florida law didn't recognize. I think I just want to push back and disagree with the fundamental premise. First, we're talking about intentional conduct, not negligent conduct. The case law already builds in a check on the issue of whether the conduct itself is appropriate for taking it to the jury. As we all know, under the Stedman case from the second DCA, the element of outrage is an issue of law. And I think that's a very important safety valve in the intentional infliction of emotional distress, because it allows a trial judge, right at the beginning of the case on a motion to dismiss, can weed out any claim that does not rise or doesn't plead facts such that the conduct does not meet the intentional standard, the outrage standard. For instance, when I was assigned to the parents of the Gabby Petito versus the parents of Brian Laundrie case, the very first motion that I heard was a motion to dismiss the intentional infliction of emotional distress on a claim that the facts did not rise to the level. And obviously I disagreed and I denied the motion to dismiss, but the point is the check of the emotional the conduct is something that the court can address right off the bat. You don't have to do any discovery on it, and it doesn't open up floodgates. So I just would push back, because I think the existing case law already builds in the protection against what Mr. Altenburn is effectively trying to argue. Now, it breaks my heart to hear what happened to your uncle, Mr. Altenburn, and there are countless number of families, both in that war and other wars, where there's just brutality. I actually would consider what Adolf Hitler did to be probably the most outrageous I've ever seen in recorded history. So I think his conduct would qualify under Florida's intentional infliction of emotional distress. And, you know, under a substantial factors test, I think your uncle perhaps would have had a cause of action against the Third Reich and Adolf Hitler. But that is besides the point. I do believe that Florida law does recognize the substantial factors test as well. And so I do believe we're going to keep it on, we are going to keep it on. So having said that, let's get to the specific language in these instructions. So, Mr. Altenburg, do you want to talk about specific language?
Well, I mean, I started off the, I don't think the first paragraph is in any different. You had wanted and ruled that you wanted the sentence that John Hopkins did not need to specifically intend the conduct of its employees to cause Beata Kowalski to commit suicide. So I've placed that there. and then say that, however, the employees of John Hopkins All Children's Hospital needed to engage in extreme and outrageous conduct with the actual intent to cause Vieta Kowalski severe emotional distress or with reckless disregard of the high probability of causing Vieta Kowalski severe emotional distress. I put that in there because we jumped from a finding in the previous count, this instruction doesn't have the issue language about the intent to cause the severe emotional distress. And especially if we have the sentence about what it is they don't need to intend, we need to repeat what they do need to attend.
Do you mean and act?
Extreme time? And she says, I've mistyped something here.
However, the employees...
To engage in extreme and outrageous conduct.
And?
Yeah.
Missing a word, and? Is that what you meant?
Yeah, the act should be and with the actual intent.
Okay, and?
And with the actual intent. And I believe that's a correct statement and it should be given. And then I jumped to, in most circumstances, the law treats an act of suicide as unforeseeable and requires the person to be responsible for their own act of suicide. That's a true statement of law, and if, once we're going to jump to this one, I believe they need to understand that this is an exceptional circumstance, and that provides that. So as a result, in order for the hospital to be liable for the death of Vieta Kowalski, you must find that her suicide was a likely result of conduct of the hospital's employees, which is probably more generous than I would like, but I think that follows the turquoise language, and then I follow this with, there are two tests that you will apply to decide this issue. First, you will use a test called the irresistible impulse test. I'm explaining this a little bit more because it's unusual to have two tests. I think they need to understand that. Because responsibility cannot be placed on someone for a suicide committed by another person who could reasonably be expected to resist thoughts of suicide, this test requires you to find that Vieta Kowalski committed suicide as a spontaneous decision brought on by an overpowering urge or desire. And that is right out of the standard English language definitions of something that is an irresistible impulse. The extreme and outrageous conduct must have driven Vieta Kowalski beyond the point where she could rationally decide against killing herself on January 7th, 2017. And that's based on the language that actually the plaintiffs requested earlier out of Nelson. The second test you will apply to decide this issue is called the substantial factor test. When someone causes another person to suffer from severe emotional distress, that stress is not always enough to make the person who causes the stress responsible for a suicide committed by a person who could reasonably be expected to resist thoughts of suicide. That sentence is too long, but I couldn't manage to shorten it last night. This test requires you to find John Hopkins All Children's Hospital is responsible for Vieta Kowalski's suicide only if you find that the severe emotional distress created by the conduct of the employees of the hospital was a substantial factor in bringing about her suicide on January 7, 2017. I've not included a definition of a substantial factor in this. I suggested some before, but frankly, they all went back to irresistible impulse. But I do believe that if the court is going to do this, there ought to be some definition of a substantial factor. From the case law, I just didn't quite know what to do.
Mr. Elligott, anything?
Yes, Your Honor. I think we're fine with the first couple paragraphs. My main concern is the words in the fourth paragraph, the paragraph that starts there, two tests, where it refers to a spontaneous decision. We don't see that in any of the case law. And really, logically, it doesn't make any difference. If these things happen over time and it builds up, I guess the decision when you ultimately do it is always spontaneous. But the concern we have here is that the defense will go in and say, oh, well, look, she thought about this for a day, or there's evidence she thought about it for a day or whatever. That should not relieve a defendant. If the defendant does cause it, or they are a substantial factor, or they lead to it, that should not relieve the defendant because the person waits a day or some period of time. So the spontaneous decision, we really object to. The paragraph that starts in most circumstances, I mean, that's basically just telling the jury some law. I don't know. And it's sort of repetitive of what comes after it anyway. I mean, in order for the hospital to be liable for the death, you must find or suicide was likely conduct of the hospital's employees. I don't think we're offended by that, although it is, again, repetitive. I mean, they're told several times you're in this and above it that the hospital has to have been responsible or been a contributing, substantial cause. So I think those are the main concerns I have there. As far as trying to define substantial, as we pointed out in the other set, I mean, the standard jury instructions that they say in the comment, we use substantial because it's a commonly substantially because it's commonly understood. I don't think it needs a further definition. I mean, obviously we could look at, something, but I mean, I think it speaks for itself. And there's, they even cite to like a really old case that came out the year I was born for the definition. So, or the reference.
In response,
let me tell you what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to give everybody one last chance to say anything. When it comes to the intentional infliction of emotional distress, wrongful death claim, I'm not going to announce. I'm just going to adjust the language and send it out. I think it's going to be easier for me to do it that way than trying to articulate here with all these different pages and whatnot. But if there's anything else you want to tell me about intentional infliction, not the damages, we'll talk about the damages in a second, but the actual instructions up to damages on IIED, wrongful death, then go ahead and say it.
I have responses. Listening to his argument on the third paragraph, what he's really saying is he doesn't want you to read the sentence, in most circumstances, the law treats an act of suicide as unforeseeable and requires a person to be responsible for their own act of suicide. A, that is exactly what the law is, and B, it's critical for this jury making this decision to understand that that's normally the law and that they're working on an exception to the law. So I believe that that's very important. As far as whether an irresistible impulse is spontaneous, that's what Webster's Dictionary says it is. When you go by the candy store and you just can't resist going in to buy the candy, it's an irresistible impulse. And this is a very different circumstance, but it's still the same. And moreover, their own expert, who I keep wanting to call Dr. Roberts, but his name is Dr. Richards, said that most suicides are triggered by an event that occurs within, I think his number was, the range ended at 72 hours. And so even their expert, I'm not sure where spontaneous ends, but says it's something that occurs because of trigger that takes place in the near time period of the suicide. So maybe there's a lesser word than spontaneous, but the notion that it has to be something that isn't thought about for a long period of time is there. I mean, this woman wrote apparently two drafts of a suicide note and then another one. We have two sets of these in, and she put together an elaborate way to do this. And the jury needs to know that that's an important concept here, because in trying to decide whether she could resist thoughts of suicide, she did an elaborate plan. So this is very important. And then on the definition, he's talking about the definition for concurring cause. And I've given you a memo. I probably have memoed you to death. But that has to do with damages rather than the causation of something like suicide. And so the fact that we have used it for many years in a combined jury instruction that was intentionally designed by that committee. I was on that committee. I know what they did on that. This is a case where we need something separate and distinct for the causation of a suicide as compared to the damages that flow from that suicide.
And on a side note, there was discussion a couple of weeks ago about not using the word irresistible, but I think it was uncontrollable.
Uncontrollable. I would still prefer that, by the way.
Yeah. So, Mr. Allegate, anything further? And then also maybe commenting on the word uncontrollable instead of irresistible.
Nothing further. As far as the words go, I think the case law that we were referring to uses irresistible.
I know that the case law says irresistible, it's, but...
Actually, it's a mixture. Most of the cases that are under this intentional infliction use uncontrollable, but the FEL case and that started it uses irresistible.
And I just wonder if the word uncontrollable is better understood than irresistible.
And in particular, because their expert tried to turn it into a psychological concept, I'd still believe uncontrollable is the safer word to use.
As long as we don't end up with the defense then arguing that our expert did not testify to that specific term, but rather irresistible.
Well, to me, the words are synonyms.
It is. I just didn't want there to be inevitable motions or objections coming from that judge. I'm fine with either one, but I tend to agree with the court that uncontrollable probably defines it a little bit better under these circumstances.
Anything else?
Sounds like I think Mr. Altenburg wanted uncontrollable also, right?
Well, I mean, I'm at this point...
He doesn't want the claim.
I get that, but...
as long as it doesn't change what it takes to be, it still needs to be a spontaneous thing that you do in this fashion. So I'm not changing the language other than you can change irresistible to uncontrollable, but the rest of it is what we need to have in there.
Yeah, I'll make that decision ultimately up to the court, I think.
Let's talk about the damage component. I don't think there was a disagreement as to the damage, but just want to make sure.
I don't think there was either. I talked too long on my computer.
They lost battery?
Yeah, no. I had to go back in and do the safety check. So, okay, I'm ready now.
So there's no disagreement as to the survivor damages?
I believe that's all standard language and accurately entered at this point.
Okay.
I think so, Your Honor.
Then the next issue is on pages of 43. And you want the primary contribution language again?
That's the only thing was the objection you have denied a couple times.
Yeah. I think that's probably coming out.
Well... and then finally on page 45, for the one with the Ada Kowalski, it's not so important because it's survival damages, but 501A2, which they put in here, starts with any bodily injury sustained by, and that's really kind of backwards of this tort because...
Okay, I'm sorry. We're on Maya's... IIED claim now?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's page 45 of the top paragraph. You award damages for any bodily injury sustained by Maya Kowalski and any resulting pain and suffering. Well, this tort actually reverses those things because it's a tort for creating emotional distress. So it ought to be for any emotional distress and for any bodily injury. I mean, if they proved it, which I'm not sure they did, any bodily injury resulting from that would be... what would happen?
Kind of like a physical manifestation stemming from the stress?
I'm not sure. I'd like to see the language and think about it, but this language is not it.
Yeah,
Mr. Elliott, any thoughts?
It's an emotional distress.
I don't think I have anything to add on this. We took out a reference to disfigurement as not being within the evidence. I don't think I have anything...
Is the issue here whether bodily injury stays in?
No, whether it comes before or after the mental anguish, I think.
I think it's how to phrase it.
Yes.
And I'll think about it, and you'll see what I end up doing, hopefully tomorrow.
I would hope and or. Mental and or bodily.
Well, okay.
So that takes us to 47.
Yeah, and that highlight was only I wanted to show you where the lawyer talking to witnesses is, and so It's going to be on page 47 in that spot because you didn't want to put it up front. And then the blue language is non-duplication language. I wasn't sure where to put it, but that seemed like it. Initially, I tried to put it up front, and that didn't seem like the appropriate spot, so I put it here. There's no standard language on this, but I've used language very similar to this on a number of occasions in the past.
How are we going to, how is the jury supposed to take this when we are separating out damages for individual torts and be able to accurately comprehend where one starts and the other one stops? I do not agree with language other than a very general statement that to the effect that...
This is a pretty general statement.
Should not.
Well, I'm open to something more specific, but we've got false imprisonments and batteries taking place simultaneously, for example, and his whole goal is to maximize the damages by getting them to award multiple things over and over again. And these things, hospitalizations, that every time she goes in the hospital, it's going to be for all of these things, according to him. And so they have to have non-duplication so that they think through the fact that if we awarded hospitalization or lost wages for this last claim, how does that impact this claim? Because they go through this series by series.
I was always for the idea that if you took a set of damages and if any one of a series of causes of action awarded the same damages, you had those damages. The decision's been made. We're going to do it separately. I do not want the jury out there confused about, well, we awarded this much for this. Now, how am I going to separate the mental anguish from this from this? It seems like an impossible task.
Mr. Anderson, I need to rein you in, man. This is appellate talk. This is not in front of a jury talk. Let's just get this. I'm okay with the concept of non-duplication. I'll look at it a little bit more, but I think some sort of statement that Mr. Altenburn is suggesting is probably appropriate.
And I'm wide open to any alterations or changes you want to make on this, because again, it's not a standard one, and this case is more confusing than normal because there are so many claims.
And Your Honor, I would note that in the jury instruction, or excuse me, in the jury verdict form, we have a couple different ways of wording it, maybe, but we have a non-duplication instruction in the verdict form.
Yeah, I've seen that. So is there anything else on the jury instruction? Because I think that was the last one that I saw.
Not to my knowledge.
Just to the best of your ability, you should avoid duplication or something to that.
Okay. I will have some sort of non-duplication instruction in there because I think it's important. And I think it's the jury needs some direction on it. That being said, I think we have now dealt with the jury instructions. Our next task would be the verdict form. I would propose that we take, a 5-minute or so break since we've been at this for an hour and 45 minutes.
Okay.
Any objection to?
No.
We have unanimous agreement that we're going to take a break. 5 minutes. You did.
Your Honor.
Hold on a second.
Sorry.
I need to get my computer unlocked here. Can't even see you yet.
Okay. Sorry.
There you are.
Good. Mr. Whitney is out there somewhere in a waiting room or something. Could you let him in? Because some of this damage, the damage questions that we have, he's going to be more familiar than I am.
I will promote him to a panelist.
All right.
It's not quite the military rank that I'm sure he's familiar with, but in Zoom lingo, that gives him almost all access.
Any promotion is good.
Mr. Whitney is, in fact, a commander in the Navy.
I'm aware. Doesn't he fly fighter jets or something like that?
He flies nothing that cool.
Including helicopters.
Helicopters.
50,000 parts going different directions at the same time.
In any event, there's Mr. Whitney.
Sorry.
Okay. Now, let's go to the verdict form let me make a couple of general observations. I don't think the following observations are going to come as a surprise to Mr. Altenburn, since he has had a previous case with me and he knows kind of how I like to format things. But I'm going to be very specific after each question what the jury needs to do. Go to number whatever.
The directions.
And it's going to be a, it's going to be very clear. It's going to add length to the verdict form, but the ultimate goal and hope is that there will be zero room for misunderstanding. Now, that's the goal. If when you see what I do, if you think it interjects any hint of confusion as to what the jury needs to do, let me know and flag it for me.
Yes, sir.
So I will, in the version that I hopefully will get to you Friday afternoon, that will be included. Now, I will also attempt to mirror the language that we use in the jury instructions on like medical care, nursing care, and all that. If I've pulled something out for a specific claim, I will try also to pull that exact same language out from the verdict forms, such that the two should mirror each other. Again, if I fall flat on that, highlight that for me. I do like the change back to kind of what I was thinking that we would do. Liability for punitive damages right after false imprisonment, and then a separate punitive damage liability after battery.
It didn't work the other way when I.
Yeah, I think it has to be this way. Now, I want to ask very specifically as to the following. We'll use false imprisonment as an example. There are three different instances of false imprisonment that plaintiff have claimed. The verdict form as it was presented by the parties would allow, if one, two, or all three are checked, yes, would allow for a singular damage line. Instead of a damage line for each specific separate battery. Is that what both sides are specifically requesting?
Yes, I've had discussions with my client about whether we needed to itemize everything and make the verdict form even longer for the jury, and the decision was that for false imprisonment, we would just have the economic, non-economic breakdown and not more than that.
Economic, non-economic, and then under 768, the in the past and to be incurred in the future.
Well, yeah.
What's required.
Okay.
The economic, and then you have non-economics, and the non-economics are divided further into.
Okay, the first question is
there, in the compensatory damages are being aggregated for all issues of false imprisonment, as well as separately for battery. I just want to make sure advertently that each side is requesting that. Because what I don't want to have happen is I don't want either side to say Judge Carroll did not have specific line items and there's no way in the world I could determine that, let's say the jury picks on false imprisonment, two of them, and then the appellate court reverses as to one but leaves the other. I don't want the damage award coming back at me because of the lack of apportionment by claim. So I'm fine if both sides expressly say that that is what they want and they're going to lose any ability to say that Judge Carroll did not give me a specific line item for that specific false imprisonment. And so I'm fine doing it this way, but I just need both sides to tell me that that is what they want.
I'm thinking, because what you're saying is that if, for example, the Second District held that there was no false imprisonment between October 18 and October 20th because of the fact that she was still in a room just like her other room and probably didn't appreciate that she was being restrained at all, then if they've checked that box...
They check the box, yes, there was a false imprisonment between October 7th and 13th, right. But no, there wasn't a false imprisonment for October 18th and 20th. Yes, there was a false imprisonment on January 6th. Let's say the second DCA cuts the January 6th finding but leaves the October 7th through 13th. Mm-hmm. The verdict form as read would not have a damage. So effectively, it wouldn't matter if the appellate court reversed as to one so long as there was one remaining.
And I think you're right. And as a result of that, I think I need to have separate damages for A, B, and C. I think it has to be laid out separately for each one.
Okay.
We object. We think that, again, we're getting into this area of overlap, and we're willing to take the risk on this, that the damages overlap sufficiently in a category now of false imprisonment such that even if one out of them is eliminated, or even two of them are eliminated, it's not really going to affect the overall amount of those.
I'm going to separate and put additional damage lines because I think it's important to give the jury the ability to award damages for the specific conduct that it finds to be a battery, assuming that they were to find it. We'll definitely include some sort of non-duplication language. And that way it also gives the appellate court the ability to know what the jury was thinking if the jury comes back with any sort of yes finding. I mean, if they come back with a no finding, it's a academic issue at that point.
Well, note our very.
I hear that you want less damage lines on the verdict form.
I just don't want. I think it's going to breed confusion. I think it's going to breed questions, and I really don't think, based on the history of Florida law, it's going to make that much difference, because we always had in our verdict forms a number of different counts, and as long as there are the damages here, if there are any one of them that supports that, there's a basis.
Well, I'm more of a fan of interrogatory answers, and more information in my world is better, and whether that helps or hurts, it kind of is immaterial to me. I want information. We ask the jury to make findings, and that's what I'm going to have them do. They'll earn their pizza or sandwiches that they get for their lunches and dinners.
And as a result of that, I'm going to need the same thing in battery for A and B.
Yes, sir. We will recast it such that...
Are we talking about this language?
No, he has rule.
Sorry, on battery of Maya Kowalski, that is that already determined? It's going to be and the other two employees? 2A?
I was only talking about conceptually what I was going to be doing to the verdict form.
Right.
I haven't gone to any specific language.
Okay.
Was from a structural standpoint.
We have some non-duplication language down below.
I saw that, and I will. You'll see what I do, and again, I'm hoping to get this out to you all on Friday afternoon. That would be my hope. Now, let's go. If there's specific language that someone needs to address.
Ms. Paul, just pointed out.
something to me that would impact the language, the same language in the jury instructions, by the way, but she has a good point. The two other employees have been referred to in front of the jury repeatedly as the two bedside
nurses,
and probably would be less confusing to the jury if we called them bedside nurses rather than other employees.
The only testimony I'm aware of, Judge, on these photographs is that it was Kathy Beattie and a bedside nurse in the morning, and Kathy Beattie and a bedside nurse when she came back. So I think the jury might be confused as to who you're referencing. Yeah. If it says Kathy Beattie and the two other employees, I don't know that they're going to connect that. And I think if we change that to bedside nurses, it would be clearer. It's my suggestion.
Okay, well, we don't agree. There's evidence from Maya Kowalski about being dropped by
No, that's not in this case.
We're talking about the battery.
We're talking about the photographs.
Photo session or sessions.
Yes.
Her dropping in that room is
two
not a
battery.
Mr. Anderson, go to page 4, question 2A. That's where I think Ms. Crowell's is.
Yeah, I just think I think they're going to be confused by that. There's only been bedside nurses discussed as being in the room.
I am conceptually fine calling them bedside nurse, but here is...
Okay.
Here's a slight wrinkle.
Okay.
Maya Kowalski, again, has taken the position that there were not two photo sessions. There was only one.
That's true.
But I guess she also talked about there was one photo session, but there were two different hands.
Yeah. But the second hand, she says, is Kathy Beattie.
Right.
So maybe it could be Catherine Beattie.
And the bedside nurse.
And any other bedside nurse.
And any bedside nurse. Or
yeah, any bedside nurse, because we say it's two.
She says it's...
She's one.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over. Yeah, so maybe did Kathy Beattie and any bedside nurse commit a battery on January 6th? That makes sense to me, Judge. It takes out the numerical issue.
I like that.
We object. We're micromanaging the facts of this.
My job is to make a very clear instruction in verdict form. We're talking about batteries. The only evidence for the photo session, even from your own client, was Miss Beattie and the nurse. So I don't see why it's a problem to refer to it as a bedside nurse.
And I like how Miss Crowell's couched it so it also avoids the
one
versus two photo session issue. Okay. So I'll recast for that.
Judge, just in response to Mr. Anderson. Oh, I'm sorry. I retract. Never mind.
Okay. Are there other issues with language?
I think there's some questions, Your Honor, that Mr. Altenburn had raised, like on page 2.
On different elements of damage. Within the economic and non-economic, and I think Mr. Whitney might be able to speak to that because I'm not as familiar with the evidence.
Okay, well, when we talk about the aggravation and that language, I was going to mirror it to what the jury instructions were going to say. Are there other issues that I need to address?
We took out the word disfigurement. I guess the simplest way would be if there isn't anything, the jury's just not going to award for it. I mean, they know what they heard.
Judge, I'm sorry. We lost where you are.
Page 2.
It should line up with whatever is left in the jury instruction. And
yeah.
When you change that, if you could look at this, it should line up
right.
With that.
That's what I was saying right at the beginning is... Yeah. I'm going to attempt to mirror what is in the jury instructions over to the verdict form, and that it would be my intent. If I fall flat on that you know, I need you to highlight that for me. But my intent is, if I make the change over in the jury instruction, it should flow to the verdict form and mirror in the verdict form what is in the jury instruction.
I would note, by the way, on page 4, the blue and the red are the kind of two initial non-duplication languages that were being used. And there's something like that in all of the affected counts.
I'm not sure it did get repeated.
Okay. I will, you will see what I do if if we need to take out some non-duplication language or add in additional non-duplication language, you will get that opportunity. So,
and Your Honor, I what I was trying to do is figure out, and I really didn't succeed at this, figure out the red line is what we would propose, and to put it someplace near the beginning, maybe the first time, and maybe considering a second round of damages, so it doesn't get repeated all the way through there. That seems going to just make it longer.
And so if you want the red, the defense wants the blue?
I think that's correct.
Are there other language issues we need to address?
Yes.
Ms. Carlos.
On the battery, under battery?
Wherever, let's just...
2B. 2B. When it says, did Catherine Beattie commit one or other batteries on Maya Kowalski at other times described in the testimony, makes it a given that it happened?
Yeah.
I mean, that's saying, you know, as described, did she do it? And so I think if there's going to be a question, I didn't think she was sued for any other battery other than the putting on the lap and the photo. So this makes it sound like she did it. So I think that at other times described in the testimonies, it's endorsing that happened.
I was struggling with what to put there because it's a. This is the one that actually you didn't direct a verdict on for punitive damages. These are things that happened over the 100 days where she says she was touched and didn't like it in her room.
I think the only one was. I thought the only one seriously was putting on her lap and hugging her.
No, it's alleged as two different things when we specified. The points of battery that it was alleged out to three things: the EEG room, which is gone, the things that were in the chapel or somewhere else that.
All right. Okay, I hear you. So, but can it just be she commit? I don't know, but
I'll look at it. I hear the concern.
Okay.
And
all right.
Because I mean, it was the allegations are this took place in the chapel. I'm really flexible on that. I didn't know what to put down there.
If I could comment briefly, if the court would, when considering it, look to paragraph 79, we describe unwanted hugging, patting, stroking, slapping, caressing, and kissing. Some of those things occurred in a room. Some of those things occurred in and around the vicinity of the chapel.
Yeah, so, I'm not looking to limit it to the chapel or her room. I just didn't like the... as other times described.
I'll look at paragraph 79 and perhaps if that is a complete roster of the allegations, then we'll substitute that roster of allegations. But what's next? Are there other language issues that's in
I think on page 6, Your Honor, the Med-Mal, it's the next one I have. Under C, I was concerned about a little confusion there. Health supervisor, other than Sally Smith, for whom John Hopkins is legally responsible, and you see the comments out on the side, it admits it's responsible for all others, so I don't think we need the for whom it is legally responsible in there.
I'm not following what you're asking me, Mr. Allegate.
6C.
No, I'm there, but what are you trying to get me to say?
I think delete the language beginning that says for whom John Hopkins All Children's Hospital is legally responsible. Because that's redundant.
It needs to be.
So I understand the response. My
apologies.
I thought they were admitting they were responsible for everybody for all the healthcare providers other than Sally Smith.
Well, it needs to be not Dr. Hannah or Kirkpatrick. I mean, it needs to be tied to John Paul Children's Hospital.
More live courtroom coverage of the Take Care of Maya trial from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today is coming up. Press subscribe now.